Hello and welcome back to another episode. It is Cycling More, your cycling informant, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Matteo Jorgensen of Movistar. Matteo, how are you?
I'm good, David. Thanks for having me again.
Okay, so we're having a look back at your 2022 season. Dive straight in. So you started in the Mallorca Classic, the kind of, I'm going to call them pre-season friendly races, but the first proper race for you was Provence and mountain stage, 13.4k at 6.5%, and there you are finishing in third place, beating pure climbers like Ivan Souza, Michael Stora, Latour, Alaphilippe. How was that?
Oh, that was good. I always start the season in good form. Like, I don't know why. I love training a lot. So through the winter, I always probably just train or I'm a bit too focused. And then I was in good shape for Provence. It's also in February. So it's like freezing cold. And yeah, it always suits me well. That was a nice climb. It was like a good hard day. And I just remember like feeling super good on the climb. I think I did like one of my best powers ever. I think both years at Provence, the year before when we did, this year we didn't do Ventoux. This year we did Montagne de la Lure, and last year we did Ventoux. And I think both times I did like near record performance. So it's always a good race for me.
And a nice bit of confidence to start the season off with.
Yeah, exactly. Super nice.
Then we go to Paris-Nice, and I'm interested in one thing. So you get in the breakaway stage, you finish third, but you are in the breakaway and Brandon McNulty is there. And everybody knows that he is on phenomenal form at that point in the season.
Yeah.
What does it feel like when you're in that position and I assume you're thinking he's just too good today?
I don't know if I was thinking that, but I knew he was in super good form, and I know Brandon, so I know when he's in good form, he's pretty hard to beat. But he attacked basically on the steepest part of the hardest climb towards the end of the stage, and I just remember I responded right away, like as soon as possible, and I couldn't close it. I mean, I was like the first guy following, and the gap was opening, and then I tried to flick some guys through. Nobody could pull through, so it was over then and there. He was just on a great day.
He certainly was, and he won by a long distance.
Minutes, yeah.
Yeah, a very long distance. Then you had to, was it Paris-Nice you had to abandon? Remind me, was that, did you something that sounded horrific? You ripped your hamstring or something like that?
Yeah, I did. On one of the early stages, the crosswind day, I think it was stage two or three, I crashed towards the, well, at the very end of the stage, like 4K to go, right outside 3K to go, I crashed. I somehow like, twisted over my bike, or my bike like kind of twisted my leg. My foot stayed in the pedal and it twisted my leg in a certain way that it put so much tension on my hamstring that it tore like at the junction behind my knee. And the problem was I think I tore it pretty mildly there. Paris-Nice was on my goals of the season, so I was just like so focused to keep going that I didn't really even, I mean, I told the doctor about it and he looked at it, and it was like painful those first few days after, but it wasn't that bad. But I just kept riding on it, and Paris-Nice is such a hard race that it was like putting so much stress on that tendon that I was basically every stage just like opening the gap between like the two. I was just making it way, way worse. And by the second to last, by the Torini stage, it was like so painful. I was like, I barely could walk from the hotel to the bus in the morning. And then, and then that stage, I went super deep for whatever reason. And yeah, I just made it really bad. So I had to like, after that, I got some scans like that week after in Monaco. And it was pretty bad. They were like, yeah, it's like a level 4 tear. You know, it's like what, I don't know, like American football players get and stuff. So I had to take 3 weeks completely off and do a bunch of rehab right then. So paid the price. But
and 3 weeks off at that point in the season is different. You then returned it Dauphiné was your next kind of big race. You had a one-day race before that, but having had 3 weeks off, did you feel like miles behind at Dauphiné?
No, actually. I think that break was one of the most positive things I could have done last or this year. The year before in 2021, I did a big Pyrenees. I basically had like the same run in the year before. I did well Provence, used Pyrenees as a big objective, and I went super deep in Pyrenees. And then the year before, I didn't stop. I didn't take any break. I basically went from there to Colby Bartoli to altitude camp to the Giro. And it just went really bad. I just got from Paris-Nice onwards, I got worse and worse and worse. So last or this year, being forced to actually stop, I think was like one of the most positive forces of the year. And it's something that I want to try to continue in years to come. I actually told the team in Pamplona this year that I want to try to kind of mimic that what I did. I mean, obviously not get an injury and probably not take 3 weeks completely off, but do something similar where if I target Paris-Nice again next year, use like, you know, go full in for Paris-Nice and then just stop, you know, maybe do a few races after, like up to, I don't know, Liège or something, but have that good, like maybe week or 5 days completely off the bike. Because I think the reason I had a good tour was because I was fresh physically and I was able to like train. I had a very focused training block. I didn't have to worry about racing until Dauphiné. So I had like 2 months of just putting my head down and training and trying to get better. And I think it helped me tons. Like when I actually went to altitude camp before the tour, I was fresh, ready to train, work hard. And then at the tour again, I wasn't super tired. I was still ready. So I think it was very good.
That's interesting because in the last couple of years, we've seen some of the top GC guys try different things. And Roglic is one who prefers to go for that kind of lack of racing so he can keep that freshness. It's just interesting how different riders approach Tour de France in different ways. It's interesting to hear that this kind of break has worked well for you and you're going to try and do it again next year, because we'll get on to the tour. I have lots of questions about the tour, don't you worry. Dauphiné, the level was insane. Jumbo just absolutely smashed it to bits. What was that like? You were in and amongst the GC group for quite a long time. What was that level like to race?
I mean, the level of Jumbo was super high. I think the rest of the race was mainly normal, but everyone else was on a similar playing field, but then Jumbo was just a mile ahead there. I didn't that race was for Enrique. We went there with Enrique as a GC guy and as preparation for the tour, so I didn't really like have any expectation beforehand to go for GC, but Enric crashed in the middle of the race and like pretty badly on a descent. He ended up like getting worse every day after that and then pulled out. So from like the crash onwards, basically the team was like, well, we'll just, you know, go for, I was up there in GC just because I was, you know, staying with Enric on some of the harder stages. And then I ended up kind of, the team was just like, yeah, I might as well just try GC, see why not, just for the experience. And I just remember the last day, I think I was like eighth or ninth or something GC going into the last day. And I just remember like, it didn't even feel like that hard of a stage, but on that plateau to, I forgot that climb's name, Plateau de Gouillet. No, I don't know. No, Plateau de Solisson.
Yeah.
I just had like one of the worst, it wasn't even a bomb, it wasn't even like I ran out of energy, I just got to the point where I don't know, I was just like so fatigued I couldn't even do like my normal tempo or whatever. It was brutal. I lost like 5 minutes and I was going as hard as I could possibly go to Roglic. So it was a good experience though, just to see, like, I mean, there just haven't been that many races I've gone for GC in a 1 week race, so another one of those, like, just to see kind of where I'm at.
Then we go to your first Tour de France, every cyclist's dream. What was the build up like? You normally I imagine you arrived over about Tuesday, Wednesday before the race started. What was that like, though, that build up? Were you nervous, excited? You know, what was it like?
Yeah, I was weirdly not that nervous. It had been my dream to do the tour for sure, and I guess I just had such a long lead up to it that I don't know. I wasn't like I was racing, and I just didn't have time to build up nerves. I think I was just like really focused then, and just like in a kind of a tunnel vision mode of trying to make the tour team, because I don't know how it works on other teams, but on our team, it was like I was on a long list, so I was never really confirmed to the tour until like, you know, 4 or 5 days before the tour. So in your head, you don't have like that time. You're just like focused on proving yourself and doing well in the races and, you know, getting the training done. So when it actually came time, yeah, we went, most teams did the recon for like the pavé stages in the spring, but we ended up going on our way up to the tour. We stopped in Paris, did some recon, and then went from there up to Copenhagen. And yeah, it felt like the lead up to, you know, any other race in some ways. But once you got there, and it was like you had the team presentation 2 days before, and it just felt like, yeah, a lot more going on. But it was an amazing experience, I think.
How crazy was the first sprint stage? Did you notice a difference? Did you notice a difference between a normal race, a Paris-Dauphiné sprint stage, to that?
Yeah, there were differences. I actually don't think like the bunch itself we were overly, you know, I've had days at Paris-Nice when it's like a crosswind day, and you know, the teams are more nervous and there's more crashes and there's more things happening. What made it crazy at the tour was that there were just like literally the whole country of Copenhagen was out standing on and in the road, you know? So it was like, you couldn't even like basically half the race. We were just all stuck in one position. Like you couldn't every stage. It was just like, there were points where if at the beginning you didn't like get your whole team to the front, it was just like, okay, we're here now, and it's wall to wall, and it's like to go up the side, it felt super scary because you're basically like riding right by people's feet, you know, and their arms are sticking out, and it's like, yeah, it felt like a super risky thing to do. So a lot of the time we were just like stuck, nobody moving in the whole peloton. We were just like wall to wall, and yeah, in that way it was different. But I think in some ways, just the fact that it was a 3 week race, like in Paris-Nice, I think there's more guys maybe going for it. But in those early stages of the tour, it's like you're still so far from the finish that there's still like a lot of guys. There wasn't like the same urgency, it felt like. It felt like more, okay, this is going to be a sprint stage and there's no other possibility. So,
and that big, huge bridge on the first sprint stage, I don't know about you, but it gave me the fear and like, something crashing, falling into the, like, and then it nearly happened. There was a crash. I think it was Tour Gis went pretty close to the edge. Yeah. I suppose you're used to riding across bridges. Does it make a difference? Were you worried?
Well, the difference was that we had been talking about that damn bridge for like 3 weeks before the race. It was like everyone was talking about this bridge, and it was like, I remember even flying in to Copenhagen, I looked out the window and you could see this huge bridge flying in. I'm like, holy hell, this is like, I don't know, it's like I'm flying into war right now or something. But it ended up being honestly one of the least chaotic points of the race. Like, sure, the lead-in, just because it was like this very hyped up thing, the lead-in was crazy and everyone was like, you know, there was a mega stress beforehand. But once you actually got on the bridge, it was like 8 lanes wide, and like it was a block headwind eight lanes wide. And like, yeah, there were some crashes just from people like, you know, like being really frantic about things, but it wasn't, yeah, it just ended up being, the conditions ended up being really favorable for us. And we just had like a very calm way across the bridge. You know, it's like, I still rode in the wind for a lot of it, like into this headwind, just to like keep us positioned. But there was almost no reason at all, just because, you know, the road was so damn wide.
How did you find the cobbled stage?
The college stage was fun. I think maybe one of my favorite stages of the tour. Yeah, those days are stressful. Like for me personally, I wouldn't have been stressed about that stage if we didn't have Enrique as a GC guy. But for him, it was like the key stage of the tour almost, because it's like it was the most dangerous stage for him to lose time. So it made it pretty stressful, and I would have to like stay behind certain splits that maybe I would have made on my own, but I was just trying to stay with Enrique. And then yeah, there was a point where both like Roglic, Vingegaard, and a few others were up in a group, and like there was a split on one of the sectors, and it was just me with Enrique. I was the only, basically Enrique was, well, there were a few other guys, but they had no teammates. So it was just me, and I was just like having to try to close this like 1 minute gap. And then thankfully, well, not thankfully, but we rode basically. We were trying to get back onto the group, and then like we were right there, and then there was a big crash with Roglic when they hit the hay bale, and we rode right through them and into the next group. So ended up being okay, but yeah, it's a hectic stage when you have a little climber on your team, and yeah, you're not Jumbo or Ineos really.
So, first week is dealt with. Second week begins with the stage to Megève, and the fight for the break is just, it's insane. Like, I went back ahead of this interview to go and watch it again. I still couldn't quite believe the fight for the break that day. It was insane is the only word I can think of. You
Yeah.
managed to make the break. It's a big break, but then Kamna's in it, and then he's got a chance to take yellow. So the tactics in the break are kind of crazy. Some teams have two men. Bettiol goes for the big attack. Then there's the protesters on the road, so the race gets stopped for a bit. It was just one of those stages that was absolutely
Yeah.
brilliant to watch. How did you go about making the break? First and foremost, how did you get in the break?
Yeah, it's funny you say that it was like a ridiculous fight for the break, because at the time it obviously felt like a super long fight for the break, but we had just already had, I mean, that was stage 10. So we had already had maybe like 4 or 5 different days just like that of like, it taking 2 hours or however long for the break to go. And so by then I kind of half expected it, but it's like the problem is to make those breaks is you just don't know that it's gonna go. Like there's nothing telling you that it's gonna take that long. It's like, sure, this is a day where a lot of guys could win, and like a lot of guys had already lost time and whatever, but there are plenty of days like that in the tour, and sometimes the break just goes in 10 minutes, and the road's easy to block, and it gets blocked, and then it's over. So yeah, those days. Like that day, I even in my head tried to. I remember I tried to wait. I was like, okay, I'll like give it. I remember telling myself, okay, 20K, because it was like a 20K, or like, I don't know how long. It was a long downhill, and then we started to kind of go up a little, and then down towards to the Lake Geneva, and then kind of turned around and went back. And like I just let the first downhill pass, and I was like, okay, that'll pass. And then I started kind of being active on that first climb, and from then onwards, I was just like part of the fight for the break. Once you start in those attacks, it's like you can't really stop. It's like you don't know when it's gonna go. So I was basically just attacking for probably 50K, in various groups, chaos, like going left, right. Yeah. So eventually, just when I think on legs, like the GC guys ended up all kind of like marking each other out, making sure none of them were in it. And then once that happens, and there's enough teams represented and guys are tired enough, it just kind of goes, and the group can be huge like it was that day, or not that big. And it ended up being pretty huge and pretty complicated with the amount of different guys. Some teams had like three riders. It just, yeah, it ends up being kind of a weird situation after that.
And then, so towards the end of the stage, Luis Leon Sanchez gets away. He's got Fred Wright in the group who's marking every attack. and it looks like Sanchez might actually do it and stay away, then you manage to get away. You're chasing him, Wright doesn't manage to respond, and then I'm thinking, here we go, because we can see you're catching him. But then Schultz managed to get out of the break as well, and then he goes past you, and then you come back together. Yeah. It was a brilliant finish. It was a brilliant finish to watch. And then, lo and behold, Magnus Cort, who was dropped like 10K earlier, goes and wins the stage. I mean...
Yeah, it was hectic. I just remember there was... I remember on the profile, I'd seen that there was like one ramp towards the end of the climb that was just a bit steeper. Because that climb to Megève was like... I mean, I had never done it. And I think like the years that they had done it in the past, they went... There's like 80 ways to get to the top there. It's like all these little like neighborhood roads. And so there's nothing, like you don't really know how it's going to be at the climb. You don't like know where the hard sections are and et cetera. Because like even the time that Sepp Kuss won in the Dauphiné, they went up a completely different, it was a completely different profile of the climb. So thankfully, Patchy on the radio told me right before that last steep kicker, he was like, okay, if you're going to go, this is the only time going into it. So yeah, I just went, and Schultz, like you said, came up to me, and then at the very end of like, there's this last pinch of the climb where you like all the spectators kind of, there were a ton of spectators at once, and it was like kind of the steepest moment right before it flattens off. And he even came by me and then attacked me over the top of that, and just gapped me off. And I was like, eventually it was like all three of us were solo. There was like Louis Slay up still solo, Nick going to him, and then me solo and Van Barl behind us. And I was like, well, there's really no rush here to try to get to those two, because I don't think they're going to work together. Like, us three aren't going to work together up there, because it's just like Louis Slay has a teammate behind, whatever. So I kind of just paced it back onto them, and by the time I got there, Van Barl got there behind me a few, like maybe a minute later, and yeah, none of us worked together well. And then I actually learned, I don't know, a few weeks ago by rewatching it, that it was kind of Benjamin Thomas that won the race for Magnus Cort. Yeah. That's what it seemed like to me. You know, it's like he just did like an all-out suicide pull for no reason for like 2 kilometers to bring that group back, and then got like last in the sprint of the group. And I was like, what was that for? You know, but. Yeah, when you have Magnus Cort in the group, it's like impossible to win.
It was Kamna as well, because Kamna then, before Thomas did that, Kamna was pulling because he'd obviously been told it could go into yellow. I mean, the stage had everything. I think, what was it? He lost yellow by about 10 seconds or something.
Small.
But I mean, what a sensational stage to watch. And then you go to stage 13, going to Saint-Étienne, another crazy start to the stage. Yeah. Everybody's going for the breakaway, but the sprinters think that they might be able to win it as well. So Ghana, Tung and yourself managed to get away. I think it was a Cat 3 climb. Ghana seemed to be putting out some crazy watts. You and Kung were just happy. Well, happy, not happy, but you were sitting in his wheel.
I was pretty happy, yeah.
What was he putting out some crazy watts?
Yeah. Oh my God. That was like one of those moments where I realized kind of like the levels of pro cycling, you know, when I was following. Yeah. I mean, that day was similar to the Megève stage where we started on this long, like downhill valley, and it went into that Cat 3 climb. And I don't know, I think it was like a 5 minute climb. Yeah. It was a 5 minute climb because I think I did my best 5 minute power ever. And basically we just went up it, and Ghana went to the front at the bottom. We like turn left on the climb. Ghana just goes to the front, never gets out of the saddle, just stays seated and just starts cranking, you know? And I'm like, oh, okay, this is like, I'll just sit on this. And I literally didn't even get out of his draft and set my best 5 minute power of all time. And at the top, look back, nobody, there was not a single guy behind me. It was just Ghana, Kung, me, and a huge gap of no one. And I was like, holy hell, this is... And I think it was, even over the top, it was headwind, or like cross headwind. And I just remember thinking, like, I don't know what this guy's power meter is reading right now, but it's some historic stuff happening. But
So then the
Yeah.
three of yous get away, and then there's a large group. I think there's about 15 or so behind, but the three of you are putting out some big power, and the group behind aren't getting to you. And then Alpecin start riding in the bunch to close it down for Philipsen. They do manage to close it down, but then there's no domestiques left. And then Simmons and Pedersen do a all-out solo crazy attack to get across to you guys.
Yeah.
And then it's a whole day of cat and mouse with a bunch. Yeah. Again, it was another amazing stage to watch. Pedersen goes and wins. He had pretty insane legs that day.
Yeah, he did.
Did you get the feeling? I think the three of you, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the three of you obviously used up a lot of energy in that earlier section. And then Pedersen's a little bit fresher. And I think, was it Pedersen, Wright and Hulley who came across? And they were 1-2-3.
Yeah.
Do you think you probably used up too much?
I definitely think I did. I made two mistakes. Maybe not mistakes, but in the beginning, doing my best 5 minute power of all time in the first hour of one of the stages, like, is not a productive thing to do, really. That's mistake maybe number one, but at least it got me into the breakaway. And then the second mistake is I just never really believed the whole day that we would make it. It just felt like one of those breaks that we were just like being held there, and it would have just like it was just going to come back at the end with no problem. And it was only until, like, I don't remember who, I think Caleb Ewan crashed, and some things happened behind, and like the group kind of sat up for a couple of minutes and then went back and sat up, and it was only then that I started to kind of think like we might make it. And I just didn't really give it a think of how it was going to play out. I thought in my head that Pedersen was going to want to keep it together. So to me, he was the least dangerous to attack. And I thought, okay, he's going to win the sprint out of this group, like, no problem. So he's just going to want to cover all the moves from guys like Kung and Ghana. Because Kung and Ghana, I felt like could win solo out of the group if they got away and we looked at each other. So I was basically just looking at Kung and Ghana because of what happened in the morning and how hard they went and how good I thought their legs were. And then when Mads attacked up the right, it completely caught me. I think it caught all of us off guard, like the whole group. And I think like Fred and Hugo responded immediately, and I was towards the back of the group, and I basically just I rolled the dice and I just relied on Ghana. I thought Ghana, or sorry, Kung. I thought Kung was going to be able to close it. And eventually, like, Kung tried for a minute, and I didn't, like, we were going pretty hard, so I didn't really look around him. I was just like had my head down in his draft for a minute. And by the time he like flicked his elbow, the gap was huge. It was over. Like, Pedersen was, I think they probably had like 200 meters on us. And then the fact that, Hugo and I mean, Fred Wright, I understand maybe he could beat him in a sprint, but those guys working with Mads, it just made it, it made it impossible for us to close. And also, I think that we were all, I think the three of us were probably the least strong in the group at that point because of what we had done that morning. So it was like, it just ended up being, I just tactically played it wrong in my head.
I think everybody watching thought the same. I think everybody expected Mads to wait for the sprint.
Yeah.
The attack was absolutely perfection from him in terms of catching everybody out. And by the time
for
he reacted, he's gone. And obviously he was super strong that day as well.
Yeah,
then we roll to stage 16 to Foix. And it was one of these days where the break actually went pretty easy. We were all expecting another 2 hours of fun. And then I think it was it Paulus? Paulus went to the front on a little drag.
Yeah.
And put in a fairly good effort. It didn't look like anything ridiculous.
No.
A group of maybe about 8 got away. Then I think you and some others jumped across. And then road was blocked. Brakes gone.
Yeah. That day there was like a rise right when kilometer zero hit, you could see this, it was a straight road, you could see this rise in front of us, and it just went like on the first move, it just kind of split. And the guys that wanted to be in the break were already at the front, so it was just like literally the front of the race accelerated, and then it was blocked right behind us, and that was the end of it. And Jumbo was doing that tactic of putting guys in the break anyway, so it was like perfect for them because they had Wout and I can't remember who else. I think they had two guys, maybe Wout and Van Hooijdonk in that break or something. And yeah, that day was probably like the least or the most disappointing day for me. I felt like that was the day I was closest to winning, and it just like the end again was one of those like chaotic, really chaotic like finals where even the race radio didn't have the information that we needed. Like in the car, they weren't able, they just didn't know the situation on the road. Because there was action in both the break group and the peloton at the same time. So it ended up being like the TV cameras were focused on the peloton when things were happening in the break. And like, yeah, basically it came down to on that, there were two climbs, and on the descent in between the two climbs, well, we had dropped most of the guys in the break up that first climb. It was like me, it was Wout, Geshka, me, and Brandon, I think, over the first climb. And we went down, and a bunch of guys caught back on the descent because none of us were really like working well together. Wout wasn't pulling, Brandon wasn't pulling, and it was just me and Geshka. And at the like in that valley of that descent, I called the car because I had no water at all. I was completely out of water, and there was still quite a bit of the stage to go. So I called the car, went back to the car, and we were all kind of feeding at the same time. And that's exactly like the cars were right behind the group that was re-entering, like some of the guys that had gotten dropped on the previous climb. So like when I was getting bottles, there were guys that just kind of went straight to the group and attacked. And one of them was Hugo. And like I never saw him attack, and neither did Patchy in the car, and race radio didn't say anything. So until halfway up that second or the last climb, like I had no idea. I thought we were the leaders on the road, the group I was in. I had no idea that Hugo was even there, and there were no like boards telling us anything. And eventually, like Patchy told me in the car that he had like, I don't know, a minute or something. And there was only a couple K of that steep climb left, and I was like, well, I don't know what it's going to take to pull back a minute in like 2K, but it just felt like defeat right there. And over the top of the climb, he still had, I think, 25 seconds, and I think it was I thought in my head maybe it was possible in a descent to like my objective was on that last descent too, because I was with Mike Woods, who's a teammate of Hugo Hull. So my objective was to try to drop Mike on the descent and get up to Hugo at the same time. So take basically just all that being said is just take huge risk on the descent, because the only way I close 25 seconds on this descent is by taking big risk, and the only way I drop Mike is by taking big risk. So I just kind of went for it, and of course I crashed like on the one dangerous corner. And yeah, it was over right there. But that was the day that I still have the most, I guess, regret about. I don't know what I could have done different other than maybe paying more attention in that day. But yeah, one of those disappointing days.
I think it's the best I've ever seen you ride that day. I mean, what was
Yeah.
it, Port de l'Hers, and it's a serious climbing group. You've got guys like Vlasov, to be fair, he was still coming back from his crash, but he was still good enough to make the break.
Yeah.
Danny Martinez, guys like proper guys
Yeah, Caruso, I think.
who
Yeah.
can win Grand Tours. And it went crazy on the climb, and then you're making the front group, as you said. The McNulty's there, Van Aert's there, and then you've got the two guys from FDJ. Was it Madouas and it wasn't Godu, Madouas and somebody else,
Storer,
Storer,
Storer.
Storer, and
Yeah.
they're riding for each other, and they set a crazy pace on the final climb, and then you attack, you drop them. The only one you can't get rid of is Woods, but to see you out climb like proper GC Grand
Yeah.
Tour winners. I mean, I know
Yeah.
it's naturally disappointing because if it had played out differently, you would have won. But like for me, that was the best I think I've ever seen you.
Yeah, I agree. That's why it's so disappointing to me, because I think I was on such a those days when you ride like that, I just didn't really realize the kind of day I was on, I think. And it's like looking back, maybe I could have started, attacked earlier on that last climb and gotten to Hugo earlier. But that's what makes it so disappointing, is that I felt, yeah, really, I was on a day that day. So I think it's good and bad. It's bittersweet, I guess.
So it was your first Tour de France. You made three breaks and all of them went all the way. That must be some type of record. You must be, I mean, that's, I don't know if you would call it luck or what, but that's pretty insane.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe it's just because I ride the brakes so hard that we make it, and then I can't win at the end.
So on reflection, was the Tour de France everything you thought it would be?
Yeah, for sure. I expected it to be like a huge circus in a lot of ways, and it was. I mean, it was great. It was like a dream come true, like being, it actually felt, it was like the first time I guess I've really felt like a recognized professional athlete, in a way. Like a lot of these races, yeah, they're big races and whatnot, but it's like being from the US, like people don't really give a shit about Tour Poland or anything. So like, none of the kids that I'm friends with, from high school or whatever, know anything except the Tour de France. So once I did the Tour de France, I actually felt like, okay, I'd made it as a professional cyclist. And yeah, that was super cool. I was glad to do it and be able to have, performances in the front. So it was a really good tour.
And how dead were the legs after the Tour de France?
Really, really dead. it was a huge load. I mean, unprecedented out of anything I've ever done. And yeah, it definitely made it to like the second half of my year. I was just behind the ball. I rested thoroughly after the tour, and if I had done more rest, there was no way I would have made it back to any sort of level. So I guess I pushed the limits on rest, and then yeah, I even had a focused training block after the tour, and I just never quite came back around. I think it was just such a big load. It would take this basically the off season I just had, these 3 weeks completely off, to kind of recover from it even. So we're like 4 months out now. So
that's what you get for following Ghana up and down.
yeah. Still recovering from that 5 minutes. My God.
I mean, is that something you would expect as you get older and stronger? Is that something you would expect? Because you see riders having the Tour de France positive bounce. Do you think that's just something that comes with age?
Yeah, I think it can come with age. I think it also depends on the person. Like some people just have the genetics to handle a load like that. Like Enrique, for example, always does the tour and then is way better for the Vuelta after, almost no matter how the tour goes. So yeah, I think there's a few factors, but hopefully it gets better with time. I mean, hopefully each one of these grand tours I get a little more depth. That would be the hope.
So after going close, still chasing that first pro win. So
yeah.
Next year, 2023, what, how,
it's the
how,
year, you, man. It's
how the are you year. Going to do it?
That's the question. Yeah, I don't know. That was my big goal this year. And I really wanted to, after the tour, like I went and did a really focused altitude camp for a month in the US after the tour to try to, because I knew I was going to do some smaller races at the end of the year in Italy and whatever, and even Tour Britain, maybe, I thought. And yeah, I just never quite made it back. But yeah, next year, I think, with a good winter, like using this winter and training well, like we always do in the winter, I think I'd like to kind of try to enter the season really good, like I normally do, and try to be super good at Paris-Nice. And I asked the team if I could do some classics next year, some of like the spring classics. So yeah, maybe somewhere in the early spring I can do it.
Ah, see, I was going to ask this question because we've spoken previously about the type of rider you can become.
Yeah.
team think it's a stage racer. I've always been thinking classics rider. So interesting to hear that you're now hoping to maybe do some classics.
Yeah, the team still wants to pursue the GC thing with me, and I agree with them, and you know, I like doing GC, and I'll do that to please them. But yeah, I think I mean, just this year, seeing like how much it just inspired me a lot to go for those breakaways and go for those one day results. Like, I just, doing GC doesn't inspire me. Like, it just doesn't, it to me, it's not like it's not the end all be all of cycling, just doing these performances and being robotic about things. I really like those breakaway wins and the guys who do that. So, and I think spring classics are a very similar thing, really, to going for stages. So yeah, I asked the team if I could do some classics, and yeah, they said yes, I can do. I think hopefully I'll be able to do Liège and maybe even some of like the, you know, true pavé classics. That'd be super fun. But yeah, I think all I know is that this year made those one day races seem a bit more, they give me a bit more motivation.
Umloop, that's all I'm saying.
Umloop, yeah,
that's the one. Nice. That's the one. You like bad weather.
It's true.
Well, in poor weather when it's cold and windy. For me, that's
Umloop. Yeah, that's a good race. I did it once. I did it in 2020. It was good. Yeah, that's a good race. It's true. The cold weather is what helps me. I need to be good in February. That's my month, I think. February or after Lombardia. If they put some races after Lombardia, maybe then.
And 2023 is also contract year. Does that have any, does that occupy any sort of mind space, or is it just put to the side?
Yeah, I mean, it does in some ways. I mean, I would like to make next year obviously my best year. I mean, I do that every year. I think every year I want to, yeah, do my best. But next year, definitely, I want to try to kind of break through a little bit. I think I'm close, and I've shown that I'm like capable of things. But there's still a difference between being capable of things and actually winning things. So, yeah, that's what I want to try to do next year.
And you've seen it firsthand. You've now ridden in the biggest race in the world against the best riders in the world. You've been very close to winning. You know the level that's required to win. And
yeah,
you were pretty close this year.
Yeah.
So next year.
Yeah, just need to get a little bit closer.
Okay, Matty Obel, thank you very much for your time and looking back at your season, and all the best for next year.
Thanks, David. Thanks so much. Spectacular diagnostics. Full Kumite, accumulate papes. First race a blade for the gate. We move from wake, you win the way. Wise ways, precise aim. Trying to rhyme like this might lead your mind strain. The times change. Flight delay, light haze. Thoughts looking like they foundation might cave. The look in my eyes resemble the ice age. The clocks of the crowd, the rent parkers sway park waves. Like moose on move raw. Involuntarily eat your full paw. Feel like a painter who can't do wrong. Fallatio from lazy do fall. To Paul Kane, but brought a broad brain with all game, you small change. He threw like a solid grand, probably 10. We push it in the hallway, on guard always.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hey, Nag Daddy. Oh, yeah. I feel like. Should be fossilized in amber. Wise commander, fuck all the lies and slanders. When it come to ill niggas, you sound like a standard. Feather to quillers, I write the standards. Cobra, cuanto tu me cobra. Tengo dinero, pero no me sobra. You want the flake of the boulder, then I'm introducing the baking soda. Into the Yoda Palace, here's some golden. I'm blowing hate circles in Minnesota. Buffaloes in their barrio. Drama with Disco King Mario. Shotty blow in the hands of the Sicario. I reload the pill off without watching his body fall. Pony ass in the mighty gone. Rainbow headband, Sylvester Stallone. Skull and bone, herringbone, wishbone. Went out for the trophy and brought the shit home. Blowing loud. Mountain Dew. Chop the rock, 16 bits, Super Nintendo. The cream rise just in the crescendo, nigga. Well, now your daddy kicking at, you know what I mean? Jump off the motherfucking cliff, live off the district, shit, my nigga. Word. Woo.